as far as free speech is concerned, as far as woke is concerned, as far as shutting down healthy talk because it's too sensitive for some, I abhor that. You know, I did not think, as much as I do not like Donald Trump, I did not think that Twitter should shut him out. And I don't think you can modulate these voices. I think you've got to, I think you've really got to let them wash over you and not take them overly seriously.
That's Barry Diller, the legendary media mogul taking a stand against efforts to limit speech. I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line Podcast.
I certainly never did set out to do a lousy movie.
As CEO of Paramount Pictures and 20th Century Fox, Barry Diller produced some of the most beloved films and television series of all time. Well, you can't tell by the way I use
my voice, I'm a woman's man. No time to talk. Dr. Jones, you're a man of many talents.
Snakes. Why did it have to be snakes?
Afternoon, everybody. Oh!
Hey, not. What's the story, Norm?
Thirsty guy walks into a bar. You finish it.
He then went on to lead businesses that revolutionized home shopping, online dating, and world travel. I spoke to Diller about how the movie business has changed.
That whole infrastructure of the hegemony, let's call it, of Hollywood, which had ruled for 75, 80 years, it only took 3 or 4 years for it to totally disappear.
The growing backlash against woke capitalism.
It is a lot from the hard right, but it's also from just ordinary, normal thinking folk who say, well, gee, that's ridiculous. I think that it's just like many things, it just went too far.
And the dangers of Donald Trump.
I was petrified that he was going to win a second term because I said, now we know. And if we do it knowing it, what is the definition of us as a people, as a country, et cetera?
And the longtime Democratic donor shared his perspective on the future of the party.
So it's time for a new generation of Democratic leadership.
Absolutely. Yes, it has to be.
Barry Diller, welcome to Firing Line.
Well, thank you. Happy to be here, at least so far.
You are the chairman and senior executive of IAC, a holding company of dozens of online brands and services. And you are the chairman and senior executive of Expedia.
I am these things.
You got your start in the mailroom of William Morris Agency.
Mm-hmm.
You went on to run, this is just a partial list, Paramount Pictures, Fox Network, QVC. And I have heard you credit your rise to a combination of serendipity and curiosity.
It's true. I think so.
Where does your tolerance for risk factor in?
It's very odd about risk because I don't see risk as most people do, at least as my observations. And it's always been true for me when I was just starting out and we started a thing called the Movie of the Week.
At ABC
in the dark ages. And I thought it was a very sound idea. It was unbelievably risky. And I didn't see the risk. I thought, this is a good idea. If I can keep the carpet under me before it gets pulled out long enough to pull it off, pull it through, it'll succeed. So it wasn't like I had courage. You know, when people say, oh my God, you take such big risks, which connotes that you can take such big risks as if you are courageous in the face of risk. I don't see the risk.
So you don't see that your success has some degree of risk willingness built into it?
Externally, of course, I know that many of the things I did were very risky. I just didn't see it. And so when you're assessing risk, which is the only point of anything, in other words, if you want to buy something that you think is going to go up in value, you assess what is the risk if you're wrong, right? I mean, that's right, wrong, risk, no risk. I don't have that gene. I'm very lucky. I see other areas of risk, but I don't see it in terms of, I never saw it in terms of careerism, my own, or projects that I was involved in.
When you were CEO of Paramount in the 70s and 80s, the best actors, writers, directors, they all wanted to make movies.
Yeah.
No one was going to television. But with the rise of premium cable, with streamers, HBO, Netflix, the most creative and the most interesting work is happening on the television screen now. Top talent, Meryl Streep, Nicole Kidman, Morgan Freeman, they have all gone to streamers too. The money to make feature films these days is mostly reserved for repeatable franchises. Top Gun this year, mm-hmm. Avatar. Mm-hmm. Can you explain to the layman, to a general audience, why has this happened?
Well, you've seen it complete. I mean, if you back up, not decades, but if you just back up 10 years ago, eight years ago, all of the tools were available, meaning there was digitization. Mm-hmm. We'd moved away from analog in terms of delivering product, programming. And in that period where all of the forces were there, they had not gathered together, but they were available to do so. The technology allowed it. Whereas 20 years ago, we didn't have enough bandwidth to be able to put directly over those wires a lot of data, a lot of video data. But we had it 7 or 8 years ago. And yet 7 or 8 years ago, we had a big cable bundle that was getting every year priced higher and higher. Every year, the number of things we were offered were getting more and more in number, and we were paying more and more for them. And cable companies, the people who warehoused all this, their margins, it used to be a very profitable business, but as programmers, particularly ESPN, et cetera, demanded more, their margins of profit decreased. So they became less interested in the big cable bundle. At just the same time, under their little noses, comes a company called Netflix, which says, we're going to stream things and deal directly with the consumer, and we got a better proposition than you cable folks do. You can watch things whenever you want. You can watch all of it at once. It's on demand, on your personal demand. And you just point and click, and it streams to you, directly to you. And out of it, under, as I say, the noses of the entire wisdom of the entertainment business, the ground completely shifts. And then along comes the pandemic, and that increases the shift because people stay home more, et cetera, so there are more subscriptions, et cetera. The entire movie business crashes, because there's no movie theaters, because people can't go to the theaters. And that whole infrastructure of the hegemony, let's call it, of Hollywood, which had ruled for 75, 80 years, it only took 3 or 4 years for it to totally disappear. Totally disappear in the sense that it's over. There is no hegemony anymore of those, let's call it, those major motion picture companies. It's truly finished. It is never coming back.
It brings me to the Oscars.
Talk about never coming back.
There's a British actress, Andrea Riseborough.
Yes.
She's been nominated for Best Actress
for this movie no one saw.
Called To Leslie. It's made less than $30,000 at the box office.
All right.
What do you think about the fact that she has a nomination for Best Actress without a big studio behind her, and it appears as though her friends broke some of the rules about lobbying for nominations?
Probably.
What's your take?
Well, I think it's not possible to say that you get from here to there without manipulation, meaning that somehow or other, they promoted themselves to enough people in the Academy to get attention for something that didn't get any attention. But it's just it's almost a comment on the whole awards process that is an antiquity. It's from a whole other era. there really is no movie business anymore. It doesn't exist. The whole motion picture role of let's say Hollywood producing about 125 movies a year, which you'd call A movies, mm-hmm. On an every year basis, rolling them out theatrically, that's over. So, and by the way, and all awards ceremonies were based upon this hierarchical process of right. a movie going to a theater, building up some word of mouth if it was successful, having that word of mouth carry itself over. And yes, there were people campaigning with to get awards and to get appreciation for it, but it was all following a kind of regular path. That path no longer exists. So whoever shows up on that path, whether it's through a movie that no one saw, through some sort of manipulation or not, and ends up in an award ceremony that every year people watch less and less, just tells you that way, I mean, there are people old enough, younger than me, but old enough to have been alive during the entire transition right now from right. a rising world, say 10 years ago, to 5 years ago, 4 years ago, 3 years ago, until the pandemic, that was pretty predictable, to one that is completely unpredictable.
Do you think about is there a reform formula for the Oscars?
No.
Should awards be granted for best in class or best
films? I actually think that there's an industry around it that has grown up around awards and that have proliferated over the last, period. But I really think that they are no longer a national audience worth its candle, because that audience is really no longer interested.
They're not interested in the awards
they're
and
not,
the showmanship of the awards.
They're not interested in the whole process of it. They're just, by the way, the awards don't reflect their interests either. It used to be that there was congruence mm-hmm. between the movies that people went to see and the awards that were given to those movies that were most popular. Not that they were the most necessarily or the least artistic or whatever, but there was a real correlation between popular movies and the giving of blessings on those movies and the people in them. But that disappeared a while ago, and the awards went to movies that nobody watched, yeah. nobody went to see, and then no one went to see anything because the pandemic came. So the whole house has kind of collapsed upon itself. And what I think is that it's perfectly legitimate, given the output of films. And by the way, again, I'd call it films rather than movies, because again, movies connote a theater experience, yeah. and that's finished, yeah. mostly finished, yeah. except yeah. for, big tentpole movies. So I think that the awards ceremony should be for the industry and not for consumers. And that would change everything. Not go on ABC, not look for a big audience, not...
I see.
Just smaller
down.
Be
internally...
I think that would be nice.
So you made movies for 20 years.
I did. More.
Just to name a few for the sake of the audience. Terms of Endearment. Mm. Ordinary People. Mm-hmm. Saturday Night Fever. Grease. Home Alone. You have admitted to making movies that you called horrid. Your words, not mine, yeah. but also some that you say turned out pretty well. And I've heard you say that the 1981 historical drama Reds, starring Warren Beatty, Diane Keaton, and Jack Nicholson, is one that will be remembered 100 years from now.
Yeah, I think it will stand the test of time.
Christ, since you're the best goddamn writer around. Now, what the hell you want to waste your time with a lot of Red propaganda nobody's ever going to print?
It's the truth. Does that mean anything around here?
Are there movies that you made that you felt deserved to be remembered but were overlooked by critics and moviegoers?
I mean, like, other than Mommy Dearest.
That's the only one.
I'm kidding. In a long career, you never know. I certainly never did set out to do a lousy movie. I mean, I knew when we were in the script form of some films that we were destined to make that they weren't going to turn out that well. But it wasn't by intent. So You know, if you've been in that movie business long enough, some movies are going to surprise you this up, down, and sideways. I've been surprised on all sides of it. So, you know, I don't have one...
But you don't have one that really ought to have been better.
Or you mean that ought to have been received better?
Yeah.
I will tell you one called CB, which was... What is that radio in a car thing? What is a CB radio?
Oh, a CB radio. Yeah.
CB radio call. That we called a movie CB, and it was such a good movie that when we opened it and no one came, I said, okay, let's do this. Let's let people in for free. So we did for a week. And everybody came to see it and loved it.
Breaker, Breaker, short stack. You got a copy on that hot coffee? How about some of that original 100 mile perk me up?
That's a big 10-4 hot coffee. I appreciate your offer, but I got some serious motoring to do. What's your 10-20?
The day after we went back to people paying for it, no one came. And no one can ever figure this out.
Let me ask you about Alec Baldwin, who has just been charged for involuntary manslaughter.
Yes.
I mean, just for the sake of the audience, there was a fatal shooting on the set of the movie Rust. Should he be held responsible?
No, I think it's really unfortunate. Listen, what care should he have taken? If he's an actor playing his role as an actor, and he's on the set, and they're ready to take a shot, and someone on staff hands him a gun, he presumes that that is a safety gun, meaning it can't fire a live bullet. He's relying on other people, as he must. And so the idea that he's personally responsible is if he was careless or negligent, and what he should have done. Again, he's the actor playing a role, and there are prop men and other people around who have other responsibilities. To say he had an extra special duty, by the way, to do something that he probably had no training for, I think is absurd.
I think he's the producer on a film, too.
Yes, but he's he's a named producer. He's not really, he's not the line producer. He's not the one who's corralling the trucks and all of the stuff and all of the props and all of the equipment. You know, and to extend responsibility, the responsibility lies with the gun handler, who was either irresponsible or made a mistake. Certainly was not intent.
She has also been charged.
I understand that, but I think adding Alec Baldwin in is a bit, it's a bit grandstanding for public noise.
I think it's safe to say that you're not a fan of virtue signaling in corporate America.
I think that could be true.
You've said that so-called woke capitalism has gone too far.
Mm-hmm.
Expedia challenged Donald Trump's travel ban in 2017, but you've tried to not have your companies become entangled in the political issues of the moment, the social issues of the
moment. I don't think it's a company's responsibility to do so. And I understand that groups of employees would like companies to do so. But I think generally they're misguided. Their intent, again, is admirable. They're wanting to speak out on social issues or have the company. But that's not a company's purpose is, let's presume its products are good products, good and decent products. This is not doing antisocial things. It's not selling pornography. But let's presume its products are good. And it's a socially responsible company to its employees and to its community, which I think is what a company's responsibilities are. I do not believe that extends to companies taking political positions, no matter how nice they may sound, to X percent as against to Y percent. They don't sound so good. But it's not even the controversy. I don't think it's the business of a company to do that. I think that while certainly some aspects of environmental, social, and governance, ESG, that some of the things that have been part of that movement are good and sound, I think the pendulum swung way, way over here. And very much of it is virtue signaling. very much of it is planting trees to offset carbon. That is sounds great, except the trees aren't real, or the trees aren't placed in a place that's any good for trees, or whatever, whatever. It's done, again, for, let us call it, social reasons that are reason only in their argument, but not in their reality.
There's woke capitalism, which has drawn a fierce backlash on the right.
Yeah, I'm not on the right, but...
You're not, but we've seen Republicans threaten retaliation against companies that speak out against the politics. And in Florida in particular, Governor Ron DeSantis led the Florida legislature to actually revoke Disney's special tax status.
Yep.
Because they took a stand against him. What do you make of this new strain?
Grandstanding of the worst order.
But there's this new strain of anti-corporate populism in the Republican Party that DeSantis is embodying, that Trump sometimes embodied. And I wonder what
again,
you make of it.
I think, again, that, look, the woke thing swung too far. The beginning process of it, which is we should be more aware and more sensitive, is rational and reasonable. But when you take it to the extremes that that woke community has taken it, that, as I say, that pendulum got way swung all the way up into the side of the socket. And it is now starting to come back, and part of it starting to come back is that there's been opposition to it. It is a lot from the hard right, but it's also from just ordinary, normal thinking folk who say, well, gee, that's ridiculous. You know, it's ridiculous to shut off speech because one person out of 2,000 will be too sensitive for that person to hear that. I think that it's just like many things, it just went too far. And by the way, and then it's, of course, if it goes too far, it's very ripe for political extremism to catch on to it, to bang it.
It follows the rules of physics.
Kind of obvious,
every
yes.
reaction.
Yes.
Okay, in 1993, the original Firing Line was hosted by William F. Buckley Jr. Buckley hosted the program for 33 years, as you know, and he hosted a debate about political correctness, and they dealt with this question of free speech, which you just mentioned, which is in some ways the political antecedent to some of the conversations we're having in this woke culture today. Take a look at this clip from 1993.
We're now a nation that everybody's claiming victimhood and the right to feel hurt by all kinds of things. And it's that kind of thing, which the speech codes try to prevent, which does, I think, suppress speech. And right. I want to know if you agree with that.
I do. Lawyers call it a heckler's veto. I could say something perfectly innocuous, but if one person in this audience got offended by calling them a TV monitor, could that person silence my speech on behalf of all the others? That is why I am against speech codes. It's too subjective. You cannot have any standard that could be uniformly enforced.
The thing that's so remarkable about that to me is that's very, very conservative Judge Robert Bork.
Oh, yes.
With the very liberal Mark Green agreeing about speech codes. It's hard to imagine a conservative populist and a leader on the progressive
agreeing on anything,
let alone speech cuts right now. How do you reflect on that?
Again, I think when you are on the far sides of extremism, left or right, it's very hard to connect the tissue between. I think that the last election we had did something to pull some of it back more reasonably together.
The midterm 2022
yeah,
election.
Yes, the 22. And I think that was healthy. We'll see now whether, with the House changing, that they will, instead of taking the lead in what the country kind of dictated, which is let's not go to the extremes, let's go a little more towards the middle and not make extreme change, I think it's possible, but unlikely, that that will make it so that the two really extreme sides come together. But I think when you're dealing with these issues that have got such investment on both sides, both extreme sides, I think it's really very difficult. As far as free speech is concerned, as far as woke is concerned, as far as shutting down healthy talk because it's too sensitive for some, I abhor that. I also think that it's that you know, I did not think, as much as I do not like Donald Trump, I did not think that Twitter should shut him out. And I don't think you can modulate these voices. I think you've got to, I think you've really got to let them wash over you and not take them overly seriously. If you have a lot of people who've got argument, and there are a lot of people who've got lots of voice and argument, and now they have a method to get that out there, it's going to be mean. It's going to over-accentuate. We have so much media now that on any topic, the coverage is so pounced right on top of it and extreme in the moment that just that amount of stuff, the amount of voices, the amount of concentration is in itself destructive.
Is it just that that's destructive? Or, I mean, in the case of Twitter, when Donald Trump went off Twitter involuntarily, the incidences of conspiracy theories and the spreading of conspiracy theories drop precipitously in the weeks after. And this is quantifiable.
Yes, but they'll spike back up.
Because he's back on? If he gets back on.
Him or anyone else. It is the nature of communications. When you have so much availability, that meaning that anyone
that
and everyone has a voice. And it is such a slippery slope. Now, can you stop extreme violence, extreme sexuality, things like that? Sure you can. But can you stop really hard-edged opinion? An opinion that's, while it's not violent, it's repulsive opinion. I doubt it. I don't think it's practical.
Even if it's disproportionately representative?
It's going to be, it is, it's not disproportionately representative. It's that when you've got this much voice allowable, a certain percentage of it is going to be, let's call it, excessively noisy and negative voices. It'll probably stay relatively constant, but it's not to be, again, other than the stuff that you can absolutely identify, it is best just to let it go. Let it out. You can't bottle it up. What are you going to do?
Unless it causes an attack on the Capitol.
You cannot shut it down. You can shut down violence, and you can certainly shut down things when they get acted upon. But when you're talking just about voice, just about people expressing themselves, you get 10 people to express themselves, and one or two of those 10 people are going to say things that offend you. Get used to it. Just like get used to the concomitant, which is a certain loss of privacy.
You described Donald Trump's presidency in hindsight in a way that was quite compelling to me as what you hope will, in looking back in many years, be a, quote, accident of history.
Mm-hmm.
Can accidents happen twice?
Well, I think if it does, it is so definitional. You know, I've always thought, look, once you can make that mistake, there's a 4-year limit to that mistake. If you actually re-up it, I mean, I was petrified that he was going to win a second term because I said, now we know.
Yeah, well, and that and January 6th hadn't even happened.
And if we do it knowing it, what is the definition of us as a people, as a country, et cetera? So I think I didn't care that the accident happened once. I cared greatly that once it happened and it was known for what it was and the character of the person was known for what he is, mm-hmm. a bad character, we would be finished with it and say, okay, it was an experiment. Nothing terrible really happened, except we degraded society as a whole, I believe, during that period.
January 6th happened.
We lowered standards. We did all sorts of things during that period, some of which we have gotten back. So I'm very sobered by the consequences that it could happen again, and I fear that it could. Because I think it would change You know, I've always thought that the American people are fair. They're non-balanced. I mean, they'll do nutty things, but when the serious time comes, they are fair-minded. And I think, not by a great majority, but I think in this last election and in the 22, the 20 and the 22, that's kind of what happened. God forbid it goes the other way.
You supported President Joe Biden's campaign for president in 2020.
I did.
He's widely expected to announce that he'll run for re-election soon. Should he run again?
It's calculus that only he can make in terms of his ability. And I presume he'll do that honorably, because I think he's an honorable man. I don't agree with everything he's done by a long shot in terms of the administration. But I do think he's an honorable man, and I think that if he is capable, then, you know, I mean, in his mind, he's healthy enough, et cetera, et cetera. I don't mark age in on a numbers basis, but then...
There's different ways to be 80.
I got age. But, look, I would hope that there are people who are of a different generation who will be engaged in national politics. I think that would be a healthy thing for everybody.
You're ready.
And I'd like a lot of them.
So it's time for a new generation of Democratic leadership.
Absolutely. Yes, it has to be.
Yeah. You've predicted that TikTok will eventually be banned in the United States.
Yeah, I did. I necessarily think it should. I just think that the forces are such and the relations between these two countries are such that it's pretty difficult politically.
I mean, there's a bipartisan effort now to ban TikTok in Congress.
Yeah.
What is your view of TikTok now? Has it changed?
Oh, I think TikTok's great. I think it's great fun. I think it's perfectly
as
fun.
As a user?
Yes, as a user. Yes. I mean, I thought that's what you were asking me.
Yeah. How about...
Has it changed in its fundamentals? No.
What about as a... if the worst is true, could it be a Trojan horse for the Chinese government?
I doubt it, truly doubt it. I mean, it's beyond my competence, but I don't really think that it's in the arena of dangerous, that in fact that algorithm and the data in that algorithm, which is housed in China, poses a particular threat. I mean, TikTok is not serious activity. TikTok is little snippets of fun.
There's a Nobel Peace Prize winner from the Philippines who says that China exports the opium version of TikTok but keeps inside the spinach version of TikTok. In other words, they have, they cut off 14-year-olds after 40 minutes and they send them educational data, but they are exporting addictive material.
It is addictive. TikTok and now... whatever it's called on Instagram, the same thing. Reels. Sorry, they are addictive. They're absolutely addictive. It's the nature of our times. It's another form. It's a new form of, I wouldn't call it necessarily expression, because as you know, it's 5 seconds, 12 seconds, 27 maybe, and it's scrollable, so you can keep renewing your interest. And by the way, pictures of elephants doing interesting things to other elephants are fun to watch. It started, look, this whole thing started with, cats. I mean,
playing piano.
The whole thing of, cats twirling at the beginning of the internet period, people doing content, generated content. The truth is this generated content is pretty good. It's pretty interesting. It's pretty compelling. I defy anybody, or I shouldn't say that because that's an obvious exaggeration, but I really do defy most people. If they start scrolling on TikTok or on Facebook or Instagram, they're going to be delighted by it. They're going to be entertained by it.
Does it have
social aspects that are questionable? Yes.
Should policymakers be concerned that the Chinese government can get privacy data about American citizens by using
I do not think so.
Why?
because I don't think the privacy data, I mean, what is the data that is private that is going to be transmitted? What is actually that data? Primarily, it is two things. It is one, the people who make the content and put it up there, of which it's all grades of good, bad, somewhat indecent, to lovely, sweet, funny, etc. To the recipient, it's what you're viewing. What personal information do you really get? You might get the information that I like seeing elephants do really disgusting things. That might be the information you might extract from me personally.
But I think the idea is they can push information then based on your preferences.
Think about what is the information they're going to be able to push?
Well, there's been data that young girls have become more susceptible to eating disorders, that boys have become more susceptible to violence.
All right, wait, here's the thing. It is true that if you have a society that prizes good-looking people, that prizes glamour, that prizes these things, that in fact, you're going to educate young people that that's more important than maybe it should be on a scale. That's a societal result. You're going to have, you know, the whole thing of face shaming or other aspects of social media are a condition of our times. It's not exactly as if you can regulate this. What you have to do is get in stride of it and assimilate it in a way that's not destructive.
I think the charge is that the Chinese government can send messages to influence American citizens.
Give me an example of the kind of message they could send, because I can't figure it out. I mean, they could send a message saying China's great. I don't think that's going to resonate with people. I mean, I don't know any subtle methodology of sending those. They're sending messages. The algorithm for TikTok, you could manipulate it to be, let's just simply say it is all the social restrictions of China. But nobody would watch it, and therefore TikTok would be relegated to obscurity.
They don't have the same product internally in China that they send to the US.
Well, because they have a different social system. They have a much more regulated social system. Do we want, though, to have that kind of censorship and social system? Now, by the way, do I think it would be a bad idea? Look, as a parent, I would say I will absolutely restrict my children's usage of certain social media, which I absolutely would do.
Uh-huh.
Do I want a government policy doing it? No.
Right. Last week, the Justice Department filed its second antitrust lawsuit against Google in just over 2 years.
Yep.
This one alleges anti-competitive practices with regard to digital advertising. Your companies compete with Google in some areas, and you have been warning for years that Google is, quote, an absolute monopoly. What could fix Google?
Well, I felt for some time that when you get real market power, there has to be regulation. I do not advocate breaking up Google or breaking up Facebook or doing any of those things. What I do advocate is real regulation on the excesses that come to any enterprise that has great market power. And I think that this current litigation, I can't talk about the detail of it because I'm not educated enough in it. But I am definitely on the side of regulating the natural excessive behavior that comes to anybody that's got real market power. And I think that is now starting to come. I think that's healthy.
I'd like to ask you about digital news. You launched The Daily Beast in 2008 alongside Tina Brown,
the
legendary editor. And I first, in the interest of disclosure for the audience, you and I know somebody in common,
the
person who became the editor-in-chief after Tina Brown left. John Avalon, who happens to be my husband. You have seen now firsthand
how... And he's a very good editor.
You have seen now firsthand how original digital journalism, or online original journalism, has evolved over the last 15 years.
Yeah.
What have you learned?
What we wanted the beast to be was both kind of high and low. We wanted to be really serious about investigative journalism, and we wanted very much to speak truth to people who necessarily didn't want to hear it, people in power. And we also, low, wanted to deal with all the populist subjects that are out there. And I think we've kind of kept that balance, and I think it's a good product. I wish it didn't cost so much money to operate it, but nevertheless, I think it's done some really good work. And again, it was one of the few that actually originated. It did not simply republish other people's work; it generated new work. And I think anybody who's in the enterprise of generating new journalistic work and methods, I mean, I hope that there's always enough funding for that to happen.
Does it have to be funded? What have you learned about the profitability?
It's very, very hard. I mean, you really, yes, it is extremely hard.
And what does that say about democracy, if it's...
It says it's a tough road. It's no surprise to me, to anybody else, nor should it be to anybody else. It ain't an easy path. But nevertheless, it's what we got, and we better treasure it and improve it it, and not allow it to be captured by either side of extreme forces.
Well, is the Fourth Estate then, is journalism and reporting going to be subject of philanthropy if it can't be profitable?
I think in some cases, yes. Yeah. I think there's no question that it does. I don't know that you could call it philanthropy. I could call it social responsibility, that if you've got a large enterprise, you can devote some of your resources. You can justify devoting some of your resources to what you feel are socially responsible things to do.
Has that been what's kept you in it for so long?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I thought it would be really bad for us to abandon it.
Yeah. There is a report in the New York Times that you're considering selling.
We may. Not, by the way, one of the big conditions is sell it into what? I hope very much that if we do sell it, we would be selling it into an enterprise that will grow it and not strip it. That I really don't want to do. I think I will resist that a lot.
Let me ask you, there's a phenomenon I've noticed in Silicon Valley. Elon Musk seems to be part of this powerful wave of tech investors who have sort of gone to the right. Peter Thiel. PayPal co-founder Peter Thiel helped bankroll several election deniers this last cycle. Elon Musk even joked about being red-pilled. This term to refer to his conversion to the far right. They're not the only two. What do you make of these tech entrepreneurs and a rightward move politically?
I don't know that they've moved right. I think they are who they are. Peter Thiel has never been anything, I believe, at least in any of his statements or anything I've ever heard, and I'm not the greatest student here, but I don't think he's ever been anything but extreme. I don't think it's like exactly as if he's moved on the spectrum. I think he's an individual who's got resources, who has an absolute extreme point of view about many things. And so too does Elon Musk. I don't think that says anything, because there's many more people who are not as extreme and who are, quote, tech moguls. I don't think it's a movement.
Mark Andreessen. I mean, there's more than just...
There's some.
Yeah.
They're not, but I don't think you'd call it a majority.
It just seems odd. Elon's moved to the right, too.
I don't know that
Maybe
he's moved to the right. Do you think he's moved?
He says he has.
Really? Moved to the right.
Yeah, that's what he says.
Okay.
Well, anyway, look, your leadership of ISE, under your leadership at ISE, you held Ticketmaster as a subsidiary for a decade before it was spun off in 2008
as
a separate company 2 years before it merged with Live Nation. Ticketmaster's virtual monopoly over the concert business has been the subject of public criticism, congressional testimony, congressional outrage. What do you think about how the company developed?
Well, I can't speak to the specifics because I'm not aware of the ground specifics, but I was very much part of the merger of Ticketmaster and Live Nation. And we agreed, which I thought was appropriate, to all sorts of conditions that we had to, as a combined company, that we had to abide by in carrying out all of the various competitive or conflicts of interest in that arena between producing shows, ticketing shows, et cetera. And they were very clearly spelled out. Whether they've been followed or not is the question. If they haven't been followed, if they haven't, and that's proven through, there ought to be corrective measures taken, for sure. I just don't know the detail of it. But I do know how careful we were, with our eyes very much open, of how we had to conduct business, given that we had such strong market power.
I see your eyes light up when you talk about public art.
Yeah.
You were very involved in the High Line, the development of the High Line on the west side of Manhattan and Little Island well. What is it that you love about public art?
Whenever I come upon something that I see, and it's, you know, Columbus Circle, and I see the statue, or whatever you think of Columbus and all that, but I see that, or Central Park, and I see that at some point, you know, 100 years, 200 years ago, somebody did something active that made something happen that decades later, people come upon and go, oh my God, how did that happen? It happened by an act of will, of someone's will. And when I stand in front of something, I'm awestruck by just imagining what it took to make that happen when it happened. And I think that's the act of making public art that is free and accessible to all is kind of miraculous. And so I'm lucky enough that we have resources and that we could put some of those resources against that, because I do believe, like for Little Island and for the High Line and for some other projects we're doing, I believe that a long time from now, people will come upon that and go, wow, how'd that happen? And makes me feel very good to know, at least in my little slice of stuff, I had a part in that.
It's a legacy piece for you.
I don't think of it, the term legacy, I'm not so sure of.
You said 100 years from now.
But I'm not saying it's the legacy, it's my legacy. I'm saying that when you come upon public art, it's not the person who created, it's the fact that it got created at all, and you marvel at how did that happen, that they took 685 or 865 acres and made this central park that a city grew around it. And when you go in it and you see how thoughtful every inch and piece of how glades rise and fall and little water things come and all of the endless things that went into it, or just a statue, and you say, geez, that's impressive.
If you could travel back in time to the mailroom, William Morris Agency, give your young self one piece of advice as you were starting out your career.
I'd give the same advice I gave myself, which is read everything in sight. You know, the great thing about the mailroom for me was not the mailroom. It was the file room, when there were such things called file rooms, where there was a room bigger than this that had file cabinets all the way around it. And the entire history of the entertainment business was there. And I thought, oh my God, I get to read this. So that is what I did. I do the exact same thing.
Barry Diller, thank you for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you for allowing me to be here.